Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's special fortnightly call because we're going to be celebrating International Women's Day. And International Women's Day, for those who aren't familiar, is a global celebration of the social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women. And each year, this day serves as a powerful reminder of the progress made towards gender equality and highlights the work that's still to be done. So this year's theme is to inspire inclusion. And joining us to explore this is four fantastic panelists. We're joined by Steph, Caroline, Stella, and Kimberly. And to kick off the discussion, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to very briefly introduce themselves and why International Women's Day matters to them. And to those members, I think it's always good to give you a job to do. In the chat, I'd love you to share how you're planning to celebrate International Women's Day at your own organisation. So just to kick us off, Steph, do you want to get us started?
Hi, no, thanks very much for the invitation to participate in this important discussion. And I think especially I've done research on gender and global value chains, workers, smallholders, particularly with a gender focus over many years, and looked at lots of different sectors, agri-food sectors mainly. And all the way along the value chain, women play absolutely critical roles. And right from, I mean, the majority of consumers are women. So the people who, well, customers are very important, not consumers. Customers who buy are women. But women play critical roles as buyers in CSR. A lot of CSR people working in CSR are women. But also further along the value chain in terms of food processing, women play an absolutely critical role. They're often the majority of workers in food factories and packing, especially. So fruit, vegetables, anything that requires delicate handling. Women are probably saying fruit and vegetables and flowers, 70-80% of the workers are women. But also they play critical roles on the farms themselves. And not only as wage and casual labour, but really important and often overlooked as farmers. 25% of smallholder farmers, especially, or are it varies a lot between countries, but roughly 25% of farmers are women. But also as contributing family labour. A lot of the products that we get on our tables just wouldn't be there if women hadn't been involved in the production. So all the way along the value chain. And the other thing I think that is really critical is women play a key role, but women really are particularly for cultural and historical reasons, women are often employed at the points and work at the points which are key to the quality of produce or products. It depends whether they're processed, et cetera. And are absolutely key in terms of assuring quality and high value, the production of high value or valuable agricultural goods. I'll give some examples if I've got time. But the key is just giving the overview is that women on the whole are under-recognized. There's often very little data on them, under paid. There's big gender pay gaps in most agri-food value chains, all the way along, from right the way from the supermarkets, right the way through to the farms. Under-resourced. So if you're a female farmer, a smallholder farmer, much more difficult to get finance than if you're a male farmer. Social auditing has and social compliance has really is increasingly recognized has just really failed to pick up issues around gender discrimination. And yet women face all sorts of problems, not only in terms of unequal pay, difficulties obtaining finance, but also additional problems such as sexual harassment, gender-based violence, etc. And yet there's so much evidence that where women do experience a more equitable position, do have better pay, are better treated, etc., that those companies are much more likely to get a better value produce, have less rejections, get a better price, get more secure contracts, etc. So there's a lot of evidence there that and the communities in which they live our more buoyant communities, and also really critical, give a woman a proper income and her children are much more likely to go to school and much less likely to be working as child labour. So there are lots of reasons why gender is really critical along the whole of the agri-food supply chain. A lot of initiatives now taking place. Fair Trade Foundation has a very important gender strategy, which it's been pursuing for a number of years. Companies have now recognised, the one that I've been involved in has been Cocoa Life in relation to cocoa production and cocoa farmers, identifying issues there. And that you can really increase productivity and community resilience and supply chain resilience if you address gender inequalities and really promote women's economic empowerment in the base of the supply chain. And then just finally, I think the big one under debate at the moment is issues around human rights due diligence. And certainly, under the UN guiding principles, initially didn't have a very good gender focus, now have a much better gender focus. And if, big if, you get corporate social responsibility due diligence coming in through the EU, I know we're in the UK, but we will be affected by it. And if it does come through, that could also play a key role in terms of promoting gender equality and promoting a more gender equitable human rights and addressing some of the issues that women face at the base of the supply chain. I could talk more, but I think that's the overview, and I'm happy to give examples, particularly from Cocoa, because I am a chocoholic and it is Mother's Day coming. And I do hope I will be receiving some child-free empowering chocolate to celebrate.
Fantastic, Steph. I mean, that's just set a brilliant context for this discussion. And I want to kind of build on that now by coming to Caroline, who's got both international experience, but kind of more recent focus has been focused on kind of UK and Scotland. And I think, you know, one of your kind of comments has been is that what you're still seeing is businesses appear to be gender blind. And I wondered if you could just explain a little bit more about what we mean around gender blindness. And Caroline, do introduce yourself at the same time.
Thanks to Louise. Thanks for everyone for having me. And yeah, it's great to have the chance to talk about women workers in supply chains this International Women's Day. I've worked in the field of human trafficking and labour exploitation for over 15 years. As Louise said, all around the world, I worked for an organisation called the Global Alliance Against Trafficking Women for many years, working with self-organised groups of women worker organisations and survivor-led organisations as well. I set up an organisation in the UK called Focus on Labour Exploitation, or FLEX, and more recently, the Worker Support Centre here in Scotland. And we work with seasonal agricultural workers, amongst others. So I'll focus on that today. And I want to talk about three areas, which is, as Louise said, firstly, how the seasonal worker visa for seasonal agricultural workers in the UK is currently not embedding gender in its design and oversight, and what we can do about that.
It's headphones, isn't it?
Oh, sorry. And secondly, what our data at the Worker Support Centre says about the key issues faced by women workers in seasonal agricultural work here in the UK. And finally, what we can do to support women better. So, yeah, the Worker Support Centre, we were established just 2 years ago, and we're now proudly a four-person team, all of whom happen to be women. Some have very deep lived experience of seasonal agricultural work in the UK, so as women workers here. And from June to December 2023, we helped over 400 people in relation to seasonal agricultural work. And so the cases and the data that I'll share today are from that time period. Where gender was declared, we helped 30 women as compared to 175 men, so 15% roughly of where it was declared. So, turning to the seasonal worker visa scheme design and what steps we can take to make it more gender responsive. Firstly, it's important to say, just as Stephanie said, we don't have the data that we need yet. In fact, very little evidence has been gathered from seasonal agricultural workers in the UK, barely any in the 77 years of operation of schemes. And immigration data is not disaggregated by gender. But we know from our data, as I said, that we see women in the minority, but also from the annual DEFRA survey of workers, where again 15% of respondents were women. So women are really a minority on the seasonal worker visa in seasonal agricultural work in the UK. So what do we know about the specific risks to women? So the fact that women are in a minority in a high risk workplace is significant, as we know that where women are operating in workplaces dominated by men, the power imbalance that they already face in society is exaggerated. And the International Labour Organization has found that women are more likely to face sexual harassment when working in sectors dominated by men. Similarly, tied visas like the seasonal worker visa is known for creating a power imbalance between employers and employees. And this imbalance is intensified for women workers. So much of the analysis of tied and temporary visa programs in countries around the world has found that sexual violence and harassment are a real feature of these programs. You only have to look, for example, to the USA, to Spain, to Italy, to see that. And in addition, seasonal agricultural work in the UK is very isolated. As many here will know, farms geographically dispersed, workers don't have access to their own transport in the main. The seasonal worker visa has no English language requirement, and most workers don't speak English or join a trade union. So that isolation is really exacerbated for women, particularly given the absence of services for migrant women who've experienced gender-based violence, for example. So as I said, at present, the seasonal worker visa is gender blind, both in its design and the guidance that's issued by the Home Office for scheme operators for its oversight. There's no mention of the increased risks to women of violence, harassment, abuse or discrimination in the Home Office guidance for scheme operators. And the design hasn't taken account of this heightened risk to women, nor the varied gendered cultural and social norms in women's countries of origin. For example, the data from last year shows workers came from 65 countries worldwide. And many people will know that the kind of key countries for the scheme last year were Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. So part of the process of establishing a gender responsive risk assessment should involve consideration of risk factors, including high rates of domestic violence and reporting stigma in countries of origin, and to introduce proactive safeguarding and reporting steps to prevent and address violence against women on the scheme. We also need to address discrimination at point of recruitment, and the ILO again promotes fair recruitment, which is non-discriminatory, including equality of opportunity and treatment. So we need a scheme that builds gender into its design and oversight, and we're not there yet. But what does this mean for women workers? And here I'll look at the Worker Support Centre data that we've had from that time period and talk a bit about the steps we've taken. So it's important to state that issues are the same. There are key risks to workers on the scheme that apply for men and women. And from our data, in order of importance, we've seen poor treatment and discrimination in workplaces, unhygienic and unsafe housing, non-payment for work issues, dismissal following worker complaints, problems transferring to alternative farms in cases of abuse, and unaddressed injuries for workers. And that's broadly reflected in the data for women. With the addition of access to healthcare, which is a particular issue for some of the women that contacted us. So how does this manifest for women workers? Well, in access to healthcare, as I said, that's been more significant for women than for men. And of particular note was in cases of pregnancy that we dealt with last year. With those we've supported expressing a real fear of contacting a GP for fear of risk of losing their jobs. And it's important to ensure that all workers understand their right to access to healthcare. And we've produced information and built awareness around this over the last year, as well as for employers to know the adjustments that they must make to accommodate pregnant women and the rights of workers to protection from discriminatory dismissal. Secondly, we've dealt with cases where workers have been housed in mixed gender caravans with no locks on doors or windows, posing a real risk to women workers of sexual violence and abuse. Shared sanitary facilities pose a similar risk. And we've heard of women placed in mixed gender housing caravans, mainly with strangers. add to this risks I mentioned of domestic abuse and challenges to reporting, and there's a real safeguarding concern. So accommodation standards must address women's safety and should be monitored. And we're working with the Scottish Government on such standards. Connected to this is sexual harassment with women we've heard who faced harassment on farms, which when reported went unaddressed. And really looking beneath what's happening for workers on farms. In one case, workers were dismissed for gross misconduct when a fight took place. The group involved mixed gender workers, including one woman, and we assisted the woman to move to another farm, but were concerned that given the violence involved, there was not an investigation to understand how gender was a factor, and really think that training should be given in gender-based violence and also trauma-informed responses. Fourthly, women workers have reported treatment and discrimination to us as issues, both in how they're treated by their supervisors, but also in relation to the jobs available to them. And often in these cases, workers just want to move to another farm, but a better system would be one that facilitates anonymous reporting and guaranteed action, as well as zero tolerance for discrimination. So to conclude where we go from here, as I mentioned, there's very, very little data on the experiences of seasonal workers. The Worker Support Centre has, for the first time, collated and sought to understand women workers' experiences, provided support and information, worked with farms and helped workers to access transfers or assisted with reports to labour market enforcement authorities. We're also contributing to policy that seeks to provide better protections to women workers, such as through housing standards, as I mentioned, and trauma-informed labour inspection, which is something that I've been working on for a number of years at Flex also. Many workers deeply fear reporting, particularly to farms, but also to UK authorities, with most workers wanting to just move on past an issue. This is particularly significant for women who face many barriers to reporting. So independent support and advice is key to build that trust with workers and to facilitate and support their access to justice. So to conclude, I would say this International Women's Day, it would be great if FNET members could support the work that the Workers Support Centre and others like us are doing, as it's really vital that independent support and reporting channels exist as a crucial mechanism to help and understand and address women's treatment in supply chains.
Fantastic. So a brilliant build on kind of Steph setting us the kind of global context, and then Caroline really putting some context on what we're looking at in a UK setting with a really clear call to action for FNET members. I really am keen that we come to some questions. So start thinking about what your questions are for Steph and Caroline as we're going to move to Stella. Now, you might remember that we have heard from Kakuzi in the past, because when Stella first started at Kakuzi, they were busy responding to 79 claimants' allegations of assault and killing and rape to do with security guards. And when Stella came in, she very much took a gender-based lens to thinking about human rights due diligence. And so it feels like a nice build from Caroline to kind of practically, how do you do it, Stella?
Thank you very much, Louise, for organizing this event. And maybe even before I go into giving my experience, I would like to say that International Women's Day is very important for me personally, because when you raise women's issues or you raise men's issues, most of the times we are labeled as difficult, as disrespectful or imposing. So this is one day that women are free to speak about their achievements, about their challenges, and in a collective way, because it's a global event. And therefore, I really appreciate International Women's Day. This year, it's about inclusion. So inclusion means that even within the groups of women, we have other vulnerabilities at the local level that must be interrogated. So this year sets us the chance to go even further. A woman like me, you might think you know what challenges I have, maybe because of where I come or the color of my skin, but maybe there are very many different diversities that come with me, not just because of where I come, things like that. So it's this year makes us interrogate further what diversity means. And so I'm very appreciative of that. So as you've introduced, Again, my name is Stella. I'm the human rights manager at Kakuzi. I've been doing this for about 3 years now. And basically, the company just made a deliberate decision based on the challenges that the company had to now implement human rights standards in accordance with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights. So it has basically entailed policy development around human rights, coming up with human rights due diligence processes, as well as setting up and implementing an operational grievance mechanism. So to answer your question about security guards, yes, being an agricultural farm, an agricultural company with ready, fresh produce, basically you can pluck an avocado from the tree and get, you know, from farm to fork. And so because it's a ready produce, it attracts a lot of lucrative thieves that want to profit from the company's produce. So that has been a conflict between the company and the surrounding community. Of course, the business has its right to protect its produce, but again, to what limit? The community has the right to sort of benefit from the company, but again, to what limit? So based on these accusations that had come, when I came in, one of the things I noted was that the security department that had all these allegations was male dominated. There was no single lady. And then, so you can imagine what does that in terms of perception. You will be seen as, you know, because men are seen to be stronger or more tough. You might be setting a bad perception about what you're trying to intend or what you mean by securing your produce. So one of the things that that we did is to avoid that segregation, that security is a masculine job. So we started a new recruitment process where we wanted to achieve at least 50-50, women 50% and men 50%. And slowly we started seeing perceptions changing because we put the women right where the interaction of the community was quite close. And we started seeing that relations were changing. I have nothing against men. I'm just saying that women, that we have different skills and women tend to be more softer, more, they communicate better, maybe. I don't know, but that perception really changed from the brutal, you know, past that had been created, and now we seemed to be friendly just by changing that workforce. However, when we started conducting human rights impact assessments, you know, HRIAs are due diligence processes. One of the things that came out is that the potential for women to disproportionately experience adverse impacts in the security department was quite high. These are areas where physically they were at risk for gender-based violence, for gender-based violence, rape, killings, murder. And so the HRIA disclosed to us that, you know what, if this could happen, women might suffer worse impacts than men. So what are you going to do? Well, because we have given you this truth. And of course, the knee-jerk reaction is to remove women quickly from that workforce. Nobody wants to be more trouble than they are. But we decided not to do that. What we decided to do is to look at the way we can have these women continue working while safeguarding them, knowing what the potential impacts are, and taking measures to ensure that we avoid, prevent, or mitigate as much as possible. So what we did is that, number one, we did a review of all the posts where they are deployed, where they work, all of them across the farm to know which areas are safer than others. But when we were doing this exercise, we realized that within the orchards, which are fenced, they have electric fences, they were much safer for everyone, not only women. So we made a decision that despite your gender, we are going to have all our guards within the orchards, and there would be no more patrolling outside of the orchards. So you can imagine, just by looking at the plight of women, we were able to now benefit everyone else. And this is what I think I will try to portray within my presentation, that when you look at one vulnerable group, when you put on a lens of diversity or inclusion, you are able to reach other people who maybe not have a voice, who may be quiet, who you may not even know exist within your workforce. And so the other thing we did is that we promoted women to be lead guards, because again, leadership is essential to empowering women, to decreasing vulnerability, to let them raise their issues whenever that are directly affecting them, and also to give them a voice in decision making. Additionally, we were able to embrace a lot of technological advances, such as CCTV cameras. We are thinking about drones. There are a lot of agricultural interventions with technology that we could continue embracing to ensure that the interactions between our security personnel and communities, or even thieves, is limited as possible. So based on those immediate interventions, we were able to develop a gendered action plan that responds to GBV, including remedies that are responsive to gendered differences. We were also able to establish gender committees across the farm, where people sit and raise issues based on gender dimensions. We are also, our operational grievance mechanism now was looking at everything from a gendered lens, and therefore even our reporting came from a gendered lens. So now that we are in 2024, I have just reviewed the action plan. We already finished an action plan last year. So this year, I am confident to move into diversity, equity, and inclusion. So the gendered framework, the gendered action plan that we were implementing previously has now transformed into a broader DEI framework, because while doing this work, I realized that we have other vulnerabilities, diversities, even within gender groups. And so for us, of course, one size cannot look like all, but for us, it was things like ethnicity, disability, sexual orientation. So I think now that we are moving into the DEI framework, it is informed by what the gendered lens was able to show us. So thank you very much, and back to you, Louise.
Stella, that's brilliant. And it's a great example of showing that, you know, when you proactively look through those that gender lens, how it can really inform your whole human rights strategy. Now, last but not least, I'm going to hand over to Kimberly, who works for Women's Win, which is a women's fund guided with the vision of a future where every girl and woman can exercise their rights. And they have recently launched a gender responsive due diligence toolkit. And so I thought it was worthwhile hearing from Kimberly, kind of, how does it work? And is it open to everyone to access?
Thank you so much, Louise. And hi, everyone. It's really great to be here. The spoiler alert is, yes, it is open source. I'm very happy to be here and talk a bit more, but also for briefly introduce myself. I'm Kimberly Schoenmaker. I have a difficult Dutch surname. I'm a programs manager at Women Win, specifically on the topic of women's economic rights, including in supply chains. And as an organization, we have been actively working in the gender and human rights due diligence space for the past 5 years, and have worked directly with different brands and companies, including those in food and agricultural value chains, such as tea and floriculture, for example. And initially, when we were researching the tools and information out there to support businesses in their gender responsive due diligence journeys, we found that multiple resources have been developed already over the years to support companies to really make their human rights due diligence process more gender responsive. And so rather than creating yet another toolkit, actually, we decided to design and establish a gender responsive due diligence platform. And this platform brings many of the resources that we found together. And I actually would like to take this opportunity to briefly share my screen to show you what the platform looks like. So it should pop up right now. Great. So yes, this platform has primarily been designed and developed for multinational companies with international supply chains. However, the guidance provided on this platform is largely relevant for suppliers and lower tier buyers as well. The setup allows you to navigate between wanting to learn more about gender responsive due diligence, or GRDD in short, to also start implementing it. And in each of the six steps, you will find an explanation of why applying a gender lens is important. It explains some practical tips as well as interactive examples of how to do so. We have also generated quite a bunch of case studies, and they, even though they focus more on commodity specific sectors, the platform really can be used by any company that has started or is going to start GRDD, and is really keen to ensure that gender is deliberately considered throughout. Then we also consolidated many resources and organized them per step to make it easier to navigate. And so finally, as a company, you might be curious about where you stand yourself in implementing gender responsive due diligence. And you might be curious about what you should focus on. And that is why we have created this straightforward self-assessment quiz. The assessment will take you through all six steps of the due diligence process and assess to what extent your company's internal and supply chain policies are gender responsive. And after completion, you will receive a personalized report. So this is my super quick, super short introduction. I will make sure to write the link to this website in the chat right after I finish. And I will stop sharing here, but I'm not yet done talking. So I think it would also be interesting to hear a little bit more about a practical example of how the platform can be used or how others have used the platform. And I think a bit similar to the conversations and the really interesting information that has already been shared earlier by Stephanie, Caroline, and Stella, I would also like to focus a bit more on step six, also providing for remediation and including grievance mechanisms. I know, Caroline, that you earlier spoke about gender-specific barriers and safeguarding concerns in reporting violations and challenges. And I think from our own partnerships with different brands, we know that this is an especially relevant and sometimes challenging topic. I think here, probably many of you are aware that the primary purpose of grievance and remediation processes is to remedy adverse impacts that have already taken place. So unfortunately, not really, beyond identifying risks to seeing, okay, sometimes things do go wrong and how do you respond to that? And then gender responsive remediation means that the processes and mechanisms are designed to ensure equal and equitable access and outcomes for both genders. And we focus a lot more on women. And to achieve this, we believe that corporate grievance mechanisms must be accessible, efficient, safe, and fair to women, really taking into account the specific barriers that women are more likely to face. So with respect to language, for example, literacy levels, access to information, digital technology, mobility, a lack of time due to unpaid care responsibilities, as well as some socioeconomic and cultural barriers such as fear and shame, and a lack of knowledge about official procedures and available assistance. I can keep going on and continuing, but I think you probably understand what I am saying. And so I think for us, we really try to help companies to become more aware of these barriers when they design and implement grievance mechanisms and remediation processes. And the platform, again, helps to provide practical tips. And there's one example on the platform that I just wanted to take my last couple of minutes and shed a little bit more light on. And that's an example from the Workers' Rights Consortium, who in 2019 published quite an alarming report after a 2-year investigation into sexual abuse at garment factories in Lesotho. I know this is an entirely different sector, but I think that some of the lessons from this can be very interesting and applied to different sectors, including the food supply chains. And here they really found that the investigation, showed that management really failed to take disciplinary action against offenders. And they saw that also the brands that were involved in supplying, sourcing from these factories, didn't have great insight into what was happening. So a lot of the abuses that were reported, they violated workers' rights under Lesotho's own labor laws, international standards, codes of conduct. The abuses were not detected by the factory's voluntary codes of conduct or monitoring programs, nor by any of the audits from the brands. And what was seen was that managers put a lot of pressure on employees to lie to auditors. And there were some specific stories shared here as well. And so after this report was published, the factories and brands involved partnered with the Workers' Rights Consortium, but as well as with local unions and local women's rights organizations to remedy the situation. There's a whole bunch of measures that were taken, which you can also read about more if you're interested in this case. But I think here, interestingly, also, and it's something that we support as well, is that WRC did not ask the brands to stop supplying from these or stop sourcing from these factories. And instead, they were asked to maintain the business relationship and use their leverage. And I think it's also quite similar to what Stella was telling us about in really keeping the engagement going and trying to improve the situation rather than moving away fully. Also thinking about the economic consequences of workers, for example. They really engaged, especially the company that owned many of the factories. They signed memoranda of understanding with three unions representing workers at the factories. And this really granted the unions access to the factories and their workers. They also changed a system whereby they would not make use of short-term contracts as much, which also had made workers especially vulnerable to abuse. Many other measures, but the program was also publicized to factory workers and really included also a program of education and training on sexual harassment, and really did this in a multi-stakeholder setting. Been kind of rushing through it a little bit, but essentially just to wrap this up, to say that this full case study can be read on the platform. We have many different examples. In case of any questions, feel free to reach out to me or any of my colleagues after this meeting. And thank you for your time and consideration. It's always really exciting to have the space to talk a bit more about gender responsive due diligence and know that more and more companies and brands are really committed to applying a gender lens to their due diligence process. So yeah, thank you for letting me speak. And Luis, I'll hand it back to you now.
Thank you, Kimberly. If you could put the link to the platform into the chat, that would be great. And now I'm aware that people might have questions, so do feel free to raise your hand if you've got a question. But I'm going to keep going with some questions for the panel, if that's all right. I'm quite interested in what businesses can do, some kind of practical top tips. I'm going to come back to you, Steph. What have you got some practical top tips? What could members do?
Right, sorry about that. I think I should have sort of introduced myself a bit more. I'm a researcher. I'm an academic from the University of Manchester. So I do come, although I've done a lot of research for different companies and on the value chains over many, many years. Just as a researcher, it's very interesting because I don't come in as an auditor or as a company or as a buyer or anything else. And I really see, so my first top tip is ask questions about gender, because I see it when I go in and we're doing research and suppliers say, so tell us about gender. We the buyers are asking us about it. We don't know. Please tell us. So I think just asking questions is really important. But asking questions at all sorts of levels, personally, just this issue of data. I mean, just have you got data? Do you know what percentage of your workers, your casual workers are female? A really important issue, sexual harassment is so often male supervisors on permanent contracts super harassing many others as well, but often harassing temporary female workers over whom they've got power and control. So, I mean, if you get a social audit where you've got 80% of supervisors are male and 80% of workers are female and the majority of them are temporary, ask questions, question it. Has the company got a good gender strategy? And I think Stella really outlined what a good thorough gender strategy could be. And has it got policies with proper complaints procedures built in? So I think just asking questions at a very fundamental level is really and kind of just constantly pushing the boat. In the longer term, things like more gender equitable living income would be critical. And as I mentioned earlier, that keeps much more likely to keep children out in school, out of work, labour, child labour and in school, for example, and enhance communities. So I think there are short term and longer term, but at least be raising the issues.
Brilliant. Fantastic. I'm going to ask the same question again to Caroline. What's your top tips, Caroline?
I think, like I said, the kind of areas where we can really try to ensure that there is much better understanding of gender-based violence and other issues facing women workers in workplaces. So through training of management, particularly, so that there's much better understanding. And also, as I said, we're looking particularly at the kind of training for labour inspectors in how trauma-informed they are, how much they understand how trauma kind of manifests in responses. And so I think that's important at all levels, and it's something that we could try to ensure, particularly in workplaces. But also, as I said, kind of ensuring independent support services are well advertised to all workers across the workplace, so that workers know about access to support. As I said, unfortunately, support for migrant workers in languages they understand for gender-based violence is almost non-existent in the UK, and therefore kind of accessing support services that can channel and facilitate access to other services is really key. And I guess I'd really underline, because it's something that we struggle with a lot, is just really ensuring non-penalization for workers that access those support services, seeing that as a kind of critical first port of call for workers to address some of the issues we've discussed today is really key.
Brilliant. And Caroline, are there any additional vulnerabilities you'd encourage people to look for when they're looking? You know, I like Steph's idea of kind of looking for, we've got too many male supervisors and less, you know, lots of women in the workforce. But I mean, what about things like caregivers? Is that something we need to be particularly looking for?
Well, we've had a range of issues this year with women workers with children that have been particularly desperate to get income to repay not only the debts that we also look at with workers coming to the UK, but particularly to support families, particularly if they're single parents. So I guess kind of in terms of the vulnerability that creates, that's quite important. But I also mentioned the countries of origin, and I think it's particularly important to look at and understand attitudes to reporting, countries of origin, likelihood of reporting for workers, and also kind of normalization of treatment of women that could manifest, which I guess are just exacerbated by risks in workplaces that I mentioned. You know, if housing is mixed gender, then that's already a risk, and then that can be amplified by other issues.
Yesterday I was on the one of the Grower Roadshow sessions, and a case study example was given about kind of different nationalities sharing a caravan, where, you know, what might not be considered really forward in one country is considered incredibly you know, forward in another country, and therefore that really increases that vulnerability if you're then sharing a caravan where you're fearful the lock isn't good on the door, or maybe there isn't even a lock on the door. So yeah, thank you for that. Stella, you know, as several of the speakers have said, you know, it was brilliant to hear your due diligence example. Can you help us with a few top tips for others who are thinking about how to put this due diligence system in place?
Thank you, Louise. I had planned to talk about due diligence, the tools, the structures, and then I'm like, no, I'm not going to talk about that, because I think sometimes we overcomplicate things. we focus on programs, structures, policies. And I think, as my parting shot, there are big things like those which would require more time, are expensive, maybe even including trade unions. And then there are other smaller things that are maybe cultural or traditional to the organization, things that maybe are not tied to the business mandate. I remembered during COVID, I was working somewhere else, and we had this 8 a.m. Monday morning meetings. And during COVID, our children came back home, and we were still trying to train them how to use Zoom. But then at work, I'm required to be on my computer at 8 a.m. That meeting could have been postponed to be at 10 a.m. There was no business mandate tied to the 8 a.m. It could have come at 10 a.m. and then people can teach their little kids how to get into Zoom. So I am saying that besides those big things, we as managers, we as whatever responsibilities we have at work, we know our workforce. We know the people who might need a bit of a break here and there. We know who came back from maternity leave, who needs this and that. So I think that besides those big programs that we like to speak about, I think that all of us should reflect on cultural, traditional practices within our businesses, even query employees. There are some things that are just done out of culture, but they would be monumental to employees if they were changed, altered, done differently. So for me, I think top tip is to query your employees about those things that could be varied and could cause good impact into their lives. Because I think at the bottom of all this all is extending humanity, extending compassion, and ensuring that the people who work for us are happy and their well-being is put first. So thank you. And back to you, Louise.
Brilliant, Stella. And just so important to get us back to the point. This is about rehumanizing the workplace. So, so key. Kimberly, what's your top tip? I think Kimberly might have frozen, actually. So I'm curious, has anybody got any questions for this incredible panel that we've got here? Anyone got anything to add that they'd like to add? Otherwise, I'm going to come back to Steph, who had some examples to share to kind of help us close out the end of this session.
Yeah, I mean, where I've probably done the most work over many years was with Cadbury, and then subsequently Mondelez, and then working on the Cocoa Life program, and that became something that. So just as an example that really integrated gender in, and just as an example, when we started doing research in cocoa, we were always told that cocoa is a male crop. Now, the reason it was a male crop is because men are the landowners because of legal and cultural, mainly cultural norms. But when we really dug down, we found that women did really critical work, especially in the immediate, in very early plant care, and then in the immediate post-harvest activities, women were absolutely dominant in those two activities. When we talked to the agronomists in Cadbury, they told us that there was constant problems with quality and productivity, etc. And then when we dug into it, the key things were early crop care and post-harvest activity. They were training all the men farmers who owned the land, but they weren't training and looking after women. So the whole strategy of Cocoa Life shifted on gender. And I think it's really had a massive impact in terms of both enhancing the quality of cocoa, which was and still is at risk in terms of levels of supply, but also in terms of enhancing the communities, because so many cocoa farmers were just leaving cocoa altogether. If you don't enhance the community, then you won't get anywhere. And I think that also then other cocoa or chocolate companies really built fair trade introduced a much more coherent gender strategy. It always had gender, but a much more proactive gender strategy. Mondelez Cocoa Life played a really key role there. So you can see, a bit like I think Stella's story, that what starts off as kind of problems builds over time. So I think it's really having that kind of forward process. The main thing is you're always taking steps forward. Don't ever think, oh, this is all too much to address. No, I just move to the next step. I do notice that around 75% of the participants here are women, by the way. So we're all in good position to keep driving this one forward.
So true that, and I've experienced that that same finding is that if you're struggling to make headway, often it is about finding women's groups, because often women's groups are more connected into the community and can be a real enabler if connected and given the opportunity. Kimberly, you're back with us. Kimberly, what were your top tips?
Yeah, sorry for that. I think definitely echoing what was already shared around, I think we often say put on your gender glasses and really look at what you're doing from a gender perspective, which indeed includes asking yourself a lot of important questions beyond, for example, collecting gender disaggregated data, but also thinking about who is at the table when any initiative or any activity or any policy is designed. And who is at the table when we look at the impact and the success of whatever we are doing? And how is that interpreted? How is that analyzed? And how do we really apply a gender lens in every single step of the process that we are taking? And I think two other maybe more practical tips. One is that we recommend a lot of companies to look into their purchasing practices. So beyond looking at the risks that women face in different supply chains, to look at who is actually leading the companies that we supply from, or that we source from, keep mixing it up, that we source from. And are some of them also women-owned businesses, or is there a good gender balance in the leadership? And so, yeah, who am I actually sourcing from? And finally, we understand that it's really important to understand the gender specific barriers in every single context and every single supply chain. And for that reason, we also very much encourage companies to try and strike up collaborations with local women's rights experts or organizations that can really provide a really valuable insight into what's happening.
Thank you.
So I think that's that.
That's fantastic. I think you'd all hopefully agree, four fantastic speakers who've really helped us kind of put on our gender lens glasses and start to think about kind of how gender impacts into our operations and into our supply chain. So thank you very, very much. I'm now going to move us on to the next part of our agenda. But if you'd like to all put your virtual hands together and give a round of applause for our fantastic speakers. Thank you very, very, very much.